Hey, welcome to the podcast. And I have the super amazing Chris Lynch, who is a patient human being, a brilliant writer. I tend to do very, very, and let's call it not super professional interviews with people. I fail at that college introduction in which you say all the accolades of a human being. But let me just say that Chris Lynch is one of the best writers I've ever read. He makes me terribly nervous because of that. But at the same time, he's an incredible human being. And all of that combined, I think, makes him such a spectacular author. We're going to have a whole bunch of links about his new book that he's promoting right now, and also about dogs, because how can we not? And Chris, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And he's all, Chris, you're in Scotland? Is that where you are?
Yep.
Yeah. But you still write for American audiences mostly?
Yeah, most of my professional life is still back there. And when I go back, I'll be going back next week. Most of my people are still in Massachusetts. I moved far away, but almost everybody, all my family and old friends are still in Massachusetts, so I'm well connected there.
Do you think that like being in two spaces in your life, you're still well connected in Massachusetts, you're living in Scotland, lets you have a special understanding about the commonalities of human beings and also the adorable, fun, quirky, I called it adorable, fun, and quirky. That's a little subjective, differences in humans too, and then allows you to be such an amazing empathetic writer that you are. Oh no.
You're gonna make this as hard as possible with the compliments.
Oh, I'm
I'll just skip
sorry.
over, well, skip over that last part, and I'll try to address what you were leading up to before. I lived in Ireland for a couple of years before this, and then I've been in Scotland for 20 something years. And yes, I do notice differences, and I notice similarities. And it's funny, I've never really set anything outside of the United States because I think that's, when I look within myself, I find myself still in Boston, really.
Really?
That's the stuff that I understand deeply. Maybe in another 20 years I'll get to Scots. But I think it's a good thing to get outside of your natural cubicle
Yeah.
to look perhaps even at your own life from a sort of an outside view.
Yeah.
I usually don't call Boston Boston because I also don't want to play that game, like spot the author's mistakes. But
I could learn from that. Yeah.
it's been helpful to me to be able to physically and kind of psychically step outside of my place. And I also get to sort of feel like this is my place and that is my place. It took years for that.
Yeah.
The first several years away, I was thinking a lot about, when I would come back. But gradually, I got the feeling that I have both places, which really is ideal for me. And it's ideal, I think, for a writer to be able to have his professional day to day in one place and
Yeah.
his personal day to day in another place. It gives you kind of freedom to not be looking over your shoulder all the time.
That sounds really, really lovely, actually.
It's been
Like
pretty
just.
good. And the fact that I have children and grandchildren here, keeps me tethered, but it
Yeah.
also means that that part of life is here. And almost, like I said, almost all my publishing world is back in the States.
That's really interesting, like that division and how you've made it work for you and how you also made me want it. Like right now, I'm like, oh yeah, we're moving. I'm just forget
Well,
this Bar Harbor Maine stuff. I'm out.
at the same time, I'm sure that one of the many reasons I'm not a household name is by the fact that I left the country. I wouldn't say that it didn't change anything.
Really?
It probably did, yeah. I mean, when I started, my first book was out 30 years ago. And when I first started, you know, if you're going to promote a book, you had to be there personally to do it.
Yeah.
This is all different. I've done a lot of interviews, you know, on Zoom, which, you know, if I had moved when this was up and running, it might have changed things somewhat. But having said that, I don't think I would really change the core of my experience because I feel like I've had everything. I was home with my kids, you know, when they were growing up. So I feel like I didn't have to really compromise.
Because you're home with your kids when you're growing up, and because you've been there for writing, like you've had, you know, you may not feel like you are a household name, but you've had this amazing, sorry, I'm complimenting you again. I'm not supposed
to. It's okay. Get it under control. We'll get there.
But you've had this amazing 30-year career of writing, of putting story out there. And that is something that many people can only dream of, you know, and hope for and aspire to. Do you approach writing as a day-to-day job? Do you feel like being home with the kids helped you understand kids a little bit more too? Like, what do you have secrets to your success? I guess is like the really bland way of asking that question.
Okay. I discovered early on, see, because I did the usual whole bunch of different jobs in between undergrad and graduate school. And by the time I went back to graduate school, you know, I was as close as possible I could be to a proper adult. I had a real job and I was married and I just had my first child when I was in Emerson in graduate school. And I was just looking around me, you know, all this stuff about, you know, I can't write if it's raining. I can't write if it's sunny. I can't write if this is happening or this is happening. I'm like, you can write when the baby says you can write. That's And it taught me, I mean, whatever inspiration might be, it'll come to you when you're working. And when you're babying yourself, it will steadfastly not come to you. So having responsibilities like that early career was hugely helpful to me. It taught me, you know, it's not so much an inspiration field as it is a discipline field. Discipline will get you there in the end in a way that waiting for inspiration never will.
Discipline will get you there in the end. Sounds like a quote that somebody's going to put on an Instagram thing because it's so wise, you know, and it's so motivating. But it also feels really New England. I was thinking like Stephen King writes that way.
Yeah,
I'm not you or Stephen King, but I'm from New England and I write that way. Like, I always feel so grateful to even have that hot second to write that I take that hot second to write because I know if I want to be a writer, I gotta write. And I like how practical you are. How do you teach that? Like, because you've taught billions and billions of people. How do you teach that? Not billions and billions. I had
problems. Well,
but, you know.
Well, I can, you know, first we tell them we cannot teach you how to publish. We really can't even talk about that. But we can teach you, like, the stuff I was just talking about. Sit yourself down. Do your work. You might have to write through a lot of crap all day to the point of really hating yourself. But if you keep your head in it, you'll get to a bit later on. There'll be a bit. There'll be that moment you'll go, wait a minute, this is the thing. This is the thing I showed up at the desk this morning for. And it might only be a paragraph, and you might throw away 12 pages of drivel, but it will all have been worth it to get to that piece, that bit that you want to show to your mother or your best friend or your writing group or somebody because you are just genuinely excited about it.
Yeah.
And the great irony is that while we're not teaching you how to publish, when you find your way to that stuff, you're actually that much closer to possibly publishing because you're getting at your best stuff. Yeah. These are the kind of things we can teach. We can teach you how to put yourself in position to get at that stuff, and how to recognize it, and how to be excited about it.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much the best we can do. You know, we can be fellow travelers.
Yeah, on the literary journey.
Yeah, because we've all been through it. It's what's probably the best thing about a writing program is that all the people you're studying with have been through the workshop process. And so
yeah,
we are hugely sympathetic.
So sympathetic. I don't want to take up too much of your time today, though I personally would talk to you forever when I was at Vermont College. For those people who don't know, Chris was a visiting. I think you were visiting. Maybe you were faculty. I don't know. Our time.
You're talking about the All Children's Writing Program.
Yeah,
right?
The All Children's Writing Program at Vermont College. And Inexcusable had just come out, I think, or was about to.
It would have come out after I left.
Yeah.
When I had my first two or three books while I was still there at Vermont, I was on the original faculty.
No way.
They had their mainstream program up and running for quite some time, but then they started a children's only program, and they started with two of their graduates, Louise Hawes,
yeah,
and Graham Salisbury. Oh. And then they had this enlightened policy where they told those two guys to hire who they wanted. And wow. They turned around and they hired Marion Dane Bauer. And then they told Marion, hire who you want. Marion turned around and hired Jack Gantos. Oh. And then they told Jack, hire who you want. And Jack Gantos hired me. And then they told me to hire who I want. And I hired Jacqueline Woodson.
No, really?
That was the original six. It was wow. Lightning in a bottle. It was amazing. I'd never been in a room where I liked five writers before. And I loved these guys.
That's amazing. I wish I had gone then. I love my staff, but like the faculty then. But like, wow. That's incredible. When I was there, I was so scared of everybody that I couldn't even say hi to you anyway. If you told me then, like, you're going to eventually get to be late to an interview with Chris Lynch because I was late and actually get to talk to him and he's going to be nice to you, I would not have believed it. I would have said it was the biggest BS I had ever heard in my entire life.
Yeah, most of us are jerks.
But I want to make sure that this is helpful for you, too, not just for our listeners who are all like, wow, Carrie's the luckiest human in the universe right now. Yeah. Screws everything up, still gets to talk to Chris Lynch. But I want to talk about walking the dog. And, you know, it's such a great, I'm not allowed to compliment you, but I cannot stop. It's a really great book. It's tender, but it's not sugary Hallmark. It like talks about crisis and kids who are lost and need hope. And for me, sometimes I think of I think it was Tobin and M.T. Anderson who said, you know, like we build our stories piece by piece and word by word and star by star, and our hope is, I'm horribly paraphrasing him because he's so eloquent, but our hope is to create the best possible stories that we can give to kids so that those kids can not only lose themselves in the story, but see themselves in the story and find hope themselves in that story. And to me, that's exactly what this story is doing. Is that your intent, or were you just writing a story?
Well, there are a lot of intents. I'm happy with that conclusion because a lot of this stuff you find, you find it kind of, almost accidentally, but you know, I even my own work, I'll look at it and I'll go, oh, I see what I was up to there, because I kind of follow it.
Yeah.
And I'm now realizing that you mentioned Tobin. I probably came back as a visitor when you were there. Maybe Inexcusable was out at that time because I was there as a faculty in 96 and 97.
Yeah, that was way before me.
Now it makes sense. Yeah. The book was, it took forever for a number of different reasons. I signed this book up in 2015.
Oh, wow.
And then for a bunch of reasons, some of them on my side, some of them on the publisher's side, you know, illnesses and car accidents and deaths in the family and sickness of sickness and then retirement and then death of editors, that I just drifted. It was like it was 9 years between signing it and it coming out. And it was, of course, a different book. It was a different world. Yeah. When I signed it up, they thought they were getting a book on police brutality. And now that you've seen the book, you go, wow, where does that fit in? There's one guy who's a quasi cop, but that's it. There were only two characters who survived from the start to the finish, Lewis and his brother. But then I finally got matched up with Kendra Levin, the editor. And, you know, what I knew, see, I usually don't aim for the top shelf hot button topics of the moment. I usually think somebody else would do that better. I look to fly a bit lower on the radar and, you know, look for like second tier stuff. And I was reading more and more of the stuff I read had the connective tissue of bystanders. Bystanders are kind of a big deal in all other stories. People who are not getting involved, people who are not. The one of the early titles of the book was The Inactivist. And that was what I came to Kendra with. I had these characters and I had this vague notion. I want a kid who's a bystander. He just doesn't want to get involved. And, you know, his kind of pilgrim's progress to becoming more integrated into the world. And Kendra kept asking, well, yeah, what's the vehicle? What is the vehicle that is going to get this kid out integrated into the world and get the world into him? Because if it's just a book of this kid sitting at home going, yeah, no, thanks, leave me out of it. I don't want to do anything. It's going to be static storytelling at best. So I had this thought for probably years now, kind of a B-plot idea that dogs make the world go round. Dog walkers make the world go round, because what percentage of news stories do you hear on the radio? That dog walkers found the body. Dog walkers found the burning car. Dog walkers found the pedestrian thrashing around helplessly in the river. If dog walkers didn't get out in the morning, what would be, what would ever make the news? So I thought that's a good vehicle for getting a guy out into the world and getting the world into him. And it has the bonus of you get to write dogs. One of my many theories is if you can't write dogs, you can't write. They do most of the work themselves. And so once I landed on that, it's really started moving. And this is my only book that the title itself has morphed over the course of the writing. Early on in the book, that saying, walking a dog, was his avoidance. Sorry, mister, I didn't see nothing. I was just walking the dog. That was his euphemism for not getting involved.
Yeah.
And then we have the Pilgrim's Progress, and late in the book, it clearly means something else. He's been walking the dogs, and the dogs have been walking him out into civilization and into human and canine interaction and experience. So the title itself changed, and that was one of those happy happenstances that I sort of stumbled on. I went, look at this. Look what you did. You're on your game, pal.
It's kind of amazing. And I love how the subconscious often plays a role in that, you know, and writing through, like you were talking about before, being diligent, working at it. And that morphing of title and meaning. But gosh, that sounds like a lot of revisions that you went
through. The subconscious is, I'll put this a little bit broadly, it's the only thing I truly believe in.
Really?
I mean, I think that story writing books, there are really three strata to it. There's conceptualization, you know, what the hell am I going to write about? And And then the bottom strata is sentence level writing, sentence and paragraph construction. And I always say, writing sentences is fun. Writing books is hard. And then there's the middle strata, which is how do I make all of this work? How do I put one foot in front of the other and assemble this mosaic into something that is bigger than just a bunch of bits and dots? I firmly believe that I'm better now at the first part and the third part than I ever was.
Yeah.
That big chunky middle part, assembling it all into something that makes sense, it bedevils me as much as it ever has.
Really?
Yes. But the other things I think have improved, and this is one reason I think you can write for kids forever, is because most of it happens when you're writing. When you're writing, you know, not overthinking. You get the overthink when you're actually walking dogs. You get the notes, you get the ideas, you get the character traits, you get the vistas. All of that you can get away from the desk, but the stuff that happens at the desk, words beget words, sentences beget sentences. And if you avoid hitting the keyboard, you will miss out on a lot of stuff that you otherwise would have written. It's a sentence will suggest another sentence to you, and you'll just follow it, and you'll tumble after it. And that is all coming out of the subconscious. It's because I'm not overthinking. I'm not over-solving. I'm going with flow. I'm going with voice. Yeah. I am going with music. And that comes up out of the subconscious, because the subconscious is, I always point back here, like it's a spot.
It's over there.
Because that's how I feel. But it's just everything, isn't it? It's everything yeah. you've ever tasted, everything you've ever seen, everything you've loved, you've hated, every life-threatening experience you've ever had, every great arancini you've ever eaten, everything is packed in there. But, you know, like Homer Simpson says, every time something comes in, something has to go out to make room for it. If you try to keep all of that on the front burner, you would fail.
Yeah.
But it's sitting there and it just comes. You don't even have to call it. It comes. It's doing the stuff. And that's why I feel confident at this late stage in my development, that there's still plenty in the tank.
I think there's plenty in that tank. Yeah.
Because I didn't have a fraction of that, obviously, when I was first publishing it 30 mm-hmm. years ago. I would have had, you know, a hinterland and a subconscious like everybody else, but it's so much more full of stuff now.
I think Marion Dane Bauer, who you mentioned before, when told me once when we were at Vermont that the people who pay attention, who observe other humans, who observe how they feel when they interact, who observe when they walk their dogs, not only find the dead bodies, but they're able to, their subconscious uses that and puts it on the page. And sometimes their empathy and their understanding, like I think for that you have in your books, that just like, it's almost like it soaks through all those words and all those sentences to create that structure of character as they, you know, like you've got this great character who uses sarcasm and they use silence and they use all this stuff as they're trying to keep themselves from dealing with some stuff. I'm trying to do this without giving away the whole entire book.
So yeah, the whole time you're doing stuff, you're walking your dogs or whatever, your subconscious is going like this, going, yeah, I'll have that, I'll have that, I'll have some of this. And then it holds on to it for you.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if you're out there all the time going, oh, this is fodder, this is stuff, this is grist for my mill, I don't think that that's as effective as just experiencing stuff.
You don't want to put on the Boston Cambridge accent and be like, I think I shall use this for my novel.
Yeah. Is that what it sounds like?
No, that's what it sounds like to me. It was really my Aunt Maxine's accent that I just tried to do for you and I failed.
Well, I grew up in Jamaica Plain, and when I left, yeah, it was like a what's his name? It escaped me. But probably Bill Barr is probably that's the kind of accent I had. So, I mean, that's another thing, you know, a couple of years in Ireland, a whole bunch of years over here. My wife is Irish and she's half English, and I welcome all influences.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would have some editors who go, there's kind of a Britishism creeping in here. And I'm like, leave it. I am the sum of my parts. I'm happy with that.
Yeah. And that allowing all the experiences and all the differences and in thought and in wording and in even in sentence structure. Let's say you've been hanging out in Germany for a long time. Like all of those things end up making your writing not the same as everybody else's writing, because it's you and your experiences on the page translated into story and other characters, but it's still what you're passionate about, what you've experienced, what you dream. When I do school visits, I always tell, I always get socially anxious, but I always also tell kids that the best writers often have the biggest lives where they say yes. It's like improv. You want to say yes to the experiences. You want to say yes to noticing things. You want to say yes to interactions, even if you're shy like me. So I think that you really embody that.
I'm not at all by nature a public facing person. Not at all.
Really?
Half of what I do say yes to is with the conscious notion that I've got to push against my nature.
Yeah.
You do yourself nothing but favors by just adding to your portfolio of experiences.
Yeah. That's great.
That's why you do it. I mean, yeah. I'm going next week to promote the book, a few stops, but
it's so you'd work. Rather hang out at home?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not get stuck waiting for an interview.
No, this I'm home.
And you have your dog won't be able to come, will they?
No. She's okay with that.
All right. Do you guys feel like she might be your objective correlative a little bit? Like, rather hang out on the couch and do a walk?
She's pretty shy.
Yeah? Relatable. Is there anything you'd like to say about your book before we go that I haven't asked and I should have, because I'm discombobulated and quirky?
No, I never like to tell an interviewer they should have done something. How would I know what you should do?
No, is there something you would like to say? Is there something you, Chris Lynch, would like to say about anything that I haven't given you the opportunity to? There, I'll rephrase.
Okay, I will say this. I borrowed a little bit from, there's a very famous women's shelter in Boston called Rosie's Place.
Oh, yeah.
It was apparently the first women's shelter in the States.
Yeah.
And the founder, Kip Tiernan, there's a quote by her that's like above the door. It's like their motto, and I nicked it. I slightly altered it.
Yeah.
But if there is a statement that stands for what I wanted to achieve in this book with this guy's Pilgrim's Progress as a human being,
yeah,
it would be that. It was the journey must be made in the company of others.
Hmm.
That's like a much more poetic version of No Man Is an Island.
It is much more. It's beautiful, really.
Yeah, I loved it when I came across it. It's a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah, it's really, really lovely. And your book is lovely, and really it hit me hard in a good way. And I think it's a very important book to be out there. And I'm very glad I had the opportunity to read it and talk to you. And I cannot plead. Throttle people, that you should all really read this book. It's coming out March 12th, I think.
Yes.
And it's called Walking the Dog. It is a novel by Chris Lynch, who is gracious here. And it's Simon & Schuster. And it's really, really, it's a beautiful story. I mean, it handles hard things that should get handled. And it handles it deftly with this, I'm sorry, I'm complimenting you again, but with this gorgeous understanding of human experience. I think Marianne Dane Bauer would be like, yes, Chris, you did this. Yeah.
Marion was never short of the right thing to say.
I know. I need her here right now for me. So thanks so much, Chris. I really appreciate it. You know,
it was my pleasure. I had a ball.
Oh, that'd be for a liar, Chris Verlinch.
And so did.
So. Yay! What a cootie face. Perfect.